Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for coming here tonight. A lovely night. We would have been far better involved fighting midges and all that kind of stuff. But I'm going to hand you right over to Alan McCrossan here, who we're very, very happy to introduce as our chairman for the night. And on you go. Now, what I have to say is keep the microphone close to your mouth.
Chairperson.
Okay.
Yes,
chair.
Thank you.
What did I say?
Chairman.
Did I? Now, you have to keep the microphone very close to your mouth from the point of view of the live streaming.
Okay, can I... Can everyone hear? No, I don't.
There's no loudspeakers, it's only for the recording.
Okay. Oh, okay, so
we're
just...
Please use the mic, it's for the live stream, we need it.
Okay.
Everyone
else
can hear you here.
Okay, so can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, as Dave said, my name is Ali McCrossan, and I'm delighted to be chairing the event this evening. I think it's really interesting to start the conversation about what people are looking for going forward. I'm delighted to introduce Tasmina and Nuala and Ailey and Leila Roxanne, and they are going to give us their thoughts on where we are and what we need to do in terms of moving forward. Just in terms of the format for tonight, everyone's going to be able to input and have their discussion from the panel this evening, and then we just been a round up about really sort of where we're moving forward, what are the opportunities, and then there'll be an opportunity for people to ask questions of the panel, and we would be delighted if people wanted to take part in that. So if I can pass you over to Tasmina.
Thank you. Would you prefer if we stood up? Are you happy for us to sit down? Would you prefer us to stand up?
Sure. Thank you very much indeed, Chair. And good evening, everybody. It's lovely to be here. I was remembering I was driving over here from Glasgow that I think once the referendum was declared sort of in 2012 and the date had been agreed, etc., and I was on the board of Yes Scotland, I think one of the very first events I spoke at was Yes Cowell. I don't know if any of you were there at it, but it was it just felt like the beginning of something really special. And I suppose I want to start by saying our movement is in really good health. We've seen a series of marches of late. I think we've astonished the press in relation to how much support we have for Scotland, again, having an opportunity to choose a different path, despite the fact that it continues to be misreported what the support is. But you can't hide people and sentiment and passion, and we're seeing that in full force. And I know some of you will be going to the march in Bannockburn tomorrow. I know there's one coming up in Edinburgh and again also in Inverness. So I'm here because I wear a couple of hats, of course, but I am a National Women's Inequalities Officer for the SNP, the national convener. And it is always of interest to me and exciting and inspiring for me to hear from young women, women from all communities, women that straddle various different minority groups. Women, of course, ourselves are not a minority group, and it was quite funny that at the very outset we had to correct that we have a chairperson. It was lovely. It's lovely when a relative correct another one. I thought it was very sweet.
I think it was actually my grandmother.
Was your grandmother? But it goes to show we are in changing times, and it's interesting that people are now finally, and certainly for women of colour, women from the LGBTI community, it's really nice to see that people are getting the language correct about what we see. And this is how we start to build the kind of country that we want to be. We are in interesting times internationally. Donald Trump continues to concern us in every single thing that he does. I am really proud to have been the MP that spoke in the very first debate when I was elected back in 2015 about banning him from the country, because my view is, I think the man is an absolute appalling animal, a monster, and the behaviour towards refugees has been disgusting. His attitude towards women is shameful, and I don't think he's learned anything. And at that time, many MPs across the House of Commons said, don't worry, when he comes to the UK, we'll teach him how to be tolerant, we'll take him to Indian restaurants and it will change his view. No, it won't. The man does not have a good soul, he doesn't have a good heart, he's not a decent person. And nothing is going to change that about him. And everyone is trying to find ways of ensuring that he's not re-elected again. I don't know, my biggest concern with him is that the language that he used and his attitudes have moved the world backwards. and things that used to be said that we've stopped saying now because they are unacceptable are suddenly creeping back into our vocabulary, and we will continue to fight against it here in Scotland. Attitudes towards immigration is completely different in Scotland than it is in the rest of the United Kingdom, and the Brexit vote, although not entirely about immigration, was very much framed in that manner. So we're here to find out how a better country can be built. Interested to discuss amongst ourselves when we think that trigger should be pulled. For what it's worth, it can't happen quick enough from my respect. But that's all I'm going to say for now. Thank you all very much indeed for coming and giving us your time on this lovely evening. I'm going to pass over to the chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jasmina. Nuala?
Hi, for anyone that doesn't know me, my name is Nuala. I'm going to speak about the main focus of tonight is going to be how we can make a better society for the LGBT community in Scotland, and the work I've done closely with young people and their interest in politics and doing locally. So my own personal journey is, I came out when I was 19, so that was last February. It took me about 2.5 years to actually come out, just because I didn't have the language. I didn't feel like I would be accepted. It was just, there was no language to help me. There was nowhere I could go and speak to like-minded people, and I just felt isolated. But when I did finally come out, it was just like this relief that I felt, and I just want to make sure that society that's accepting for all people, that they feel like they don't even need to come out in the future. It's just, that's who they are. So, there's, although Scotland, we are a very open and accepting country, and I'm really proud of that, but also there is still a long way for us all to go. To move forward, to make a more accepting society for the LGBT community, I think we need to make sure that this horrible language that has been normalised is cut out. So things like, I sit in my college class and they use these degrading phrases, but it's covered as banter when it is not, and it makes everyone uncomfortable. And language like that is being normalised, even you've got Trump also using language like that. And people are seeing these people in high positions, and they think, oh, it's just normal to say these sort of things. So then that needs to be cut out completely in order for our society to move forward. We also need to make sure that it's not a hard thing for people to do to come out, that they feel that they will be accepted straight away, because it doesn't make you any different. You're the same person that you are. So another thing is attitudes. So people like Trump, we need to get rid of, because how can we move forward as a society when people like that in office and they're just using these degraded phrases and not standing up for people? And an encounter I had recently was with William Fox. I went up to him and asked why he voted against marriage equality. His response, which was just shocking, was, oh, I didn't think it was necessary because civil partnerships are here and people that are already married will think all the legal stuff changes for them. So I asked him, I told him that was a ridiculous argument. It makes no sense. We should all have the same right to marry whoever we want to marry. And he said, well, that's where we disagree, and he ran off. So when you have narrow-minded politicians like that who can't even say why they did something, it just shows that we need to get rid of them in order to move forward and make this society more accepting and build a better Scotland. Also, another thing with that is when you hear these phrases and stuff, kids in schools think it's acceptable, and that's what results in bullying, and that needs to stop in order to move forward, because 90% of LGBT kids in school have experienced bullying. As a result of that, 27 have attempted to commit suicide, and 15% have attempted it more than once. And in this day and age, I think that's just absolutely shocking to hear those figures. And as a society, we should all be helping and standing up for these kids so that does not happen, and we just feel like they can be their true selves and be accepted for who they are. So a way to do that is we need to go into schools and educate these kids from a young age so they know that language is not acceptable and they can become more compassionate human beings, and they can take those discussions into their households and then speak to their parents and get a whole conversation going and just become more accepting people. I'm really proud in Scotland for the stuff we've done. We've been the first country in the UK to legalise same-sex marriage. We've given automatic pardons to gay men who are criminalised for being who they are. We've funded organisations and worked closely with the Thai campaign to tackle bullying within schools. We've had a consultation on the gender recognition law, which I think is brilliant. Also, our First Minister was the first ever First Minister or Prime Minister in the UK to speak at a Pride event, and I was very lucky to witness that speech. It was very moving, and it was a very passionate speech, and it meant a lot to everyone in Glasgow Green that day. It got quite emotional for some people as well. So that was just brilliant to see that happen. So to move forward is definitely engage your young people within political discussions. A recent survey I did for local people, local kids in Dunoon that are eligible to vote, with 53% of young people saying that they take a really keen interest in politics and they keep themselves up to date. They daily look at what's happening in both parliaments. I also got another result. It was over 70% want to see another referendum very soon, which I think is very, very good to hear. So we know that those kids that are wanting to vote want to see our society move forward, get away from a horrible government down in Westminster that's doing no good for anyone, get rid of ties with Trump, just get rid of that and become a more positive society to live in. So with a more positive and equal society, we need to make sure we're not continuously putting people in boxes, sort of, you're over there, someone else deal with you. We need to just treat everyone as equal, and we need to stop making some who somebody is and political policy. So as me as a gay woman, I don't want that to be someone's political policy. Like, they shouldn't make it. It should just be treat everyone as equal and make sure you're standing up for everyone, even regardless if you are not, like, anyway connected. We're all together as one society and just working together. One thing I would like to see in, like, especially small towns, is lots of LGBT groups forming. We're lucky enough that Ailey's done marvellous work in getting one sorted for our Gaelic youth, and I think that's absolutely brilliant. It just gives people a place to go and know that society will accept them for who they are. Thank you for listening. I hope that was alright.
Good evening, everyone, and thanks for joining us on such a lovely night. And you could have been out doing whatever you wanted, but thank you for listening to all of us. I'm Ailey Stewart. I am representing Argyll and Bute in the Scottish Youth Parliament currently. My term will end next year, but I've loved just working for young people in the area over the past year. I've been able to do some amazing things, like as Nuala said. I've been working closely with her and some other young people to set up an online support group for LGBT young people in the area, which I believe was one of the first of its kind. I've also been looking into the issue of period poverty and to the extent of which that spreads in our area. So I've been really honoured to serve the community over this past year and will do for the next year. But tonight I'd actually like to speak about my own opinions for how we can become a better Scotland, that don't necessarily always represent the Youth Parliament's gauge and issues, but match up on a lot of things. So I spend half my time in Dunoon and half my time in Glasgow. My partner lives in Glasgow, and I was walking through the streets today and I was actually shocked to see a lot more young people sleeping rough in the streets than I would normally see, and they were about the same age as me, which really shocked me. And youth homelessness is becoming a bigger problem in the country, yet it's just, I don't think it's talked about enough. In 2017, 34,972 homeless applications were made in Scotland, indicating the first rise of figures in 9 years. 17% of that figure was made up of single young mothers. Single young mothers who don't know whether their children will have a roof over their heads. A bit closer to home, 516 homeless applications were made in people from Argyll and Bute from 2017 to 2018. I apologise for starting my remarks on a slightly negative tone, but to see a positive change in Scotland, we first need to speak frankly about our failures. I would like to see a Scotland where councils are supported to build and improve their social housing stock. The government's target of building 50,000 new affordable homes is set to be met, which is amazing, but I want it to be exceeded, and I want them to be even more ambitious and move forward from the 50,000 mark. I also believe a better Scotland would include reforming the legislation around intentionally homeless people, thinking about how the wording around that phrase might belittle individuals. In terms of improving education in Scotland, I believe that teachers need to be more recognised as the pillars of society that they are. Teachers are moral agents and are crucial to the shaping and construction of a child's skill set. Teachers should be supported by head teachers, who in turn should be supported by the council. We need to protect and also praise the amazing work of additional support needs staff. So more funding and better pay for educators was what I'm essentially saying. So I'm sure I'll be very popular with the teachers in the room if there are any. I would also like to see a Scotland where there is even more inclusive education. Nuala touched on this quite a lot in what she said, but I believe that all non-denominational schools should be obliged to provide all pupils with heterosexual and LGBT plus sexual health information, with support from charities, amazing charities like LGBT Youth Scotland and Stonewall. I believe all teachers should be put through the training on how to handle homophobic, transphobic and biphobic behaviour. And teachers themselves should be mindful of how they treat pupils identifying as part of the LGBT community. I attended an LGBT Youth Scotland conference where parents spoke about their transgender children facing horrible sort of just belittling attitudes from their own teachers, which in result caused them to try and attempt to take their own lives. So this is something that needs to be changed, and training for all teachers should be put in place. Grassroots charities are doing amazing work. As I said, Stonewall, LGBT of Scotland and TIE as well, as Nuala mentioned. And they should be greater funded and supported to go out to schools and provide this training. Another thing I'd like to speak about is period poverty, which I mentioned briefly in my introduction. It's an issue I've been trying to involve myself in recently. The amount of women that must decide between feeding their own children or purchasing sanitary products for the sake of their own health is unbelievable. A Better Scotland will make sure there are fully supported provisions in place at schools, GPs, community centres and universities for the distribution of free sanitary products for anyone that needs them. It's ridiculous that they were actually being taxed up until very recently. The consultation survey I recently opened on this issue showed that period poverty does exist to an extent in Argyll and Bute, and I want to see appropriate measures being taken place to tackle it, which I'm happy to announce that Audrey has said there's already been progress made. Most of all, in a better Scotland, I would like to see events like this, which you've all come to, become not so much of a novelty. Young people today will become the politicians, nurses, teachers and social workers of tomorrow. Please continue to actually support us to drive the country forward. Continue to listen to us like you are tonight, and acknowledge our opinions, because a lot of our ideas do actually make a lot of sense sometimes. So thank you so much for coming out and supporting this event. Thank you.
Not even going to say what this. I don't think I'm going to stand because I have quite high platforms on, and that would require some balancing along with a laptop. So I'm going to sit this here, and I wonder if the person that's live streaming can still hear it. If it's, yep.
No, no.
It has to be.
Yeah, you have to.
Wow. Men everywhere. I want to say thank you to everybody that I'm on a panel with. It's so good to see young folk, and I'm going to say young folk, from Dunoon, part-time or not, engaged in their community, engaged from where they're from, and speaking about... And it's, I understand how difficult it is to be in a small community and be visible. And yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for speaking. It's when we start speaking, we become less frightened by each other. I also want to say thank you for welcoming me back to one of my childhood homes. I moved to Dunoon when I was 9 and left as soon as I could. Nothing to do with any teachers in this room. If there are any teachers who taught me. The teachers I had were wonderful, but I found it to be quite claustrophobic and quite difficult being a black and mixed race woman, where many people assumed that my father was black and my mother. It's true. See, this is why I didn't want my grandparents in the audience, and not my mother. And my mother was kind of invisibilised in this already like very white community. So I don't know which biographies were provided to anybody and how much anybody knows of me or how little they know of me beyond being Dave Navro's granddaughter. And I hope that reveal isn't too much of a surprise to some of you here. Nepotism finds its way over on a ferry and through a peninsula. The topic of a better country that we can become, I found quite broad and far more broad than what I'm used to speaking about. So I thought I would try and reflect on what it means to be a black Scottish and mixed race woman in Scotland. And by black, I mean of African Caribbean descent, because that's something that gets lost quite a lot in terminology that we've clumped together. And that's a very important facet that I'll turn back to. I'm also going to touch a little bit upon my work within the media and organising inside and outside of a trade union and how that intersects with other aspects of my personal and professional life. I've gone down a sort of non-traditional route towards journalism and now find myself working for The Ferret. I don't know how many of you know who or what that is, but we are an investigative journalism platform. We're a co-op, so we're owned by our members and or owned by our subscribers, and no one involved with The Ferret is a member of a political party, and that's myself included, and we take a lot of pride in that. So any of you people that write stuff on Facebook and say that we're biased towards SNP or towards Labour, we're really not. We try hard to provide like non-partisan news. That's what we pride ourselves on in Scotland. We also have Scotland's first fact-checking service, just to make sure that people are aware of what's fake, what's in between, and that comes from anything, any public claims made by politicians, by anybody in the media, or anything that anybody suggests. Two events took place in a short space of time, and I'm sure none of you really need reminding of what those were. But I like to be clear, and in 2014, as you know, we had the Scottish independence referendum, followed by the EU membership referendum in 2016. And regardless of which ideology you aligned with, notions of nationhood, home and Scotland were shaken up forever. It's completely changed the landscape that we live in. It completely changes how we identify. Scottish identity, for the first time in quite some time, became of public, political and policy interest. as did what it meant to be, or as did what it means to be Scottish within Scotland, within the UK, within Europe and worldwide. As a member of the frequently overlooked population of people of colour in Scotland, my claims to Scottish identity often spark othering responses, and get a lot of the questions of where you're really from, even though I sound like this. And this is something, you know, that and, you know, it happens a lot, and that's to make people feel comfortable, that they, once they figure that I'm not really of Scotland, that makes people feel a little bit more comfortable. But these questions remind me that I may be here and of here, but I'm not really of here. Scotland itself has a complex relationship with colonialism, with many feeling that Scotland is a victim of colonialism and has been used for the extraction of profit by a colonial master. But Scotland has also been historically a colonial master in its own right and has profited from this. Many of the beautiful buildings and assets that exist in our cities and the huge rural estates are owned by wealthy families and survive and continue to survive as daily reminders of the money that Scotland's elites made from slavery and colonialism. Opening up Scotland's constitutional questions invites us to revisit our history and understand that Scotland was not only responsible, but that it benefits from colonial crimes and continues to benefit people like us that live in this country. I'm not a huge fan of constantly referring to colonialism. There's limits to this analysis, I feel, and focusing on Scotland's history and the slave trades does very little to position black Scots on an equal footing with their white counterparts. And it can be very limiting to the identities and aspirations of black Scots, Afro-Scots, however we're choosing to identify now, many of whom have personal histories that have nothing to do with the legacies of slavery. One example is the people who arrived to Glasgow's Red Road Flats, who sought asylum in the early part of this century, and they have histories that are not as much intertwined with slavery, but the more recent crimes of the British state, such as imperial invasions and extracting resources from impoverished countries. Try saying that. Sorry, mine's not very cheery. I'll try and see if I can fit in a joke somewhere. But on that point, many of us here may agree that an independent Scotland could and should be a demilitarised Scotland. Abolition of nuclear weapons has formed a key part of our discussions around independence, but we need to ensure that we stick to our principles when we're looking at that, and not just for political purposes. We are very aware that weapons are made in Scotland today and weapon fairs are being supported by our councils in Glasgow. People make Glasgow as do weapons. And that can be used tomorrow to advance the UK's foreign policy at the expense of brown and black lives in countries that our media tend to ignore or misrepresent. The black British experience tends to exclude the lives of black Scottish people, the focus often concentrated on being black in England. I'm sure that sounds familiar to many of you living here and in this room. Many of us here understand that we may be British, but the British experience rarely recognises the nuances of being Scottish and living in Scotland. In Scotland, we often turn a blind eye to our own hostilities towards the other. We say that we cannot be the ones which other others, because we've been othered. We live in the shadow of not as bad as, we have a progressive outlook. Even in Dunoon, we live with a shadow cast by a Jim Crow monument, which I'm well aware that Stephen Lawrence's father came and made a comment about quite recently. I feel that we find it quite difficult to accept critique without feeling that we're being criticised. Our politics are often wrapped up in party colours and partisan motives. Scotland welcomes refugees, but turns a blind eye to the lack of brown and black voices and faces in our public spheres. And what happens to these non-white Scots who move from refugee status to becoming Scottish? They're faced with the same racialisation as I am, the same discrimination that people from travelling communities receive, and the same marginalisation that many of us face or will continue or will face at some point throughout the course of our lives. The Scottish Government policy at the moment often clumps together, and it's called protected characteristics, and that puts together everything into equalities, which covers women, race, people from LGBTQIA communities, those living with disabilities, amongst others. This means that these groups are often left looking to access the same funding pot, and there's little in the way of understanding that you can be a black person living with disabilities and also belong to an LGBTQIA community. Policy is then further compounded by the fact that ethnic groups are clumped together into BAME, which black and minority ethnic, a language which has historically helped raise issues which marginalised groups have faced, but again doesn't look at the nuances. My experience has been that feminism in Scotland has kind of gone down that road as well, that it doesn't tend to look women of colour and black women within its feminism, but that's a different conversation. So needless to say, I find a lot of my work is centred on equality from the perspective of a black Scottish mixed race woman, and that's important too. I live and I've lived as a person that comes from both a black and white household that's in a predominantly white country. I use these opportunities about the realities of our own hostile environments here in Scotland and attempt to position voices and experiences which reflect these realities. Just referring back to the blindness that Scotland chooses to have and how that fits into like a narrative of exceptionalism. Just this year, I was part of formed a collective for black women in Scotland, and we exhibited throughout Glasgow International. And it was held at the Govan Hill Baths, and it featured four black Scottish women identified as such, an artist, and this was the first in Scotland. And the national newspaper chose to interview another group of people of colour from London who were exhibiting as part of the art festival, who were talking and highlighting the same issues of racism, privilege, systems of oppression that, you know, we've been trying to bring to the forefront of public life for quite some time. But it suits us within Scotland, I think, to make visible or not make visible and not see black voices which are trying to say what could make Scotland a better country. And it is difficult when you are visible, very visible, in a land that also sees you as invisible, to speak out and be the person that does it. And media representation. I need to speak about media because that's where I'm involved in with the Ferret. I'm part of the National Union of Journalists and I sit on their National Executive Council and Scottish Executive Council, and the union isn't without its difficulties. A union that represents people that write unfair things and misrepresent people is quite a difficult union to be in. The media affects how people are seen and how we see ourselves. And if you're working class and if you're undocumented and if you're seeking status and if you're living with a disability, hidden or visible, if you're LGBTQIA and or black, you're unlikely to get balanced coverage of your community, and you're also unlikely to know how to challenge unfair representation. If we look at how people are portrayed by the majority of the media, it makes clear that we are still seen, and most of us are still seen and discussed as something other, and that's if we make it into pages at all. I've been following quite a lot of discussions within the industry around the Grenfell fire, and comparing it to the Glasgow School of Art fire, where one was a huge loss of life and one has been depicted as, you know, a huge loss of culture. With the Grenfell fire, I've been listening and hearing that this is a real life impact of a disappearing local news source, that no one was there to pick up the story. We know that this might well be the case, but residents had voiced concerns over housing, social policy, over concerns and safety, over their homes, and concerns which were hugely, hugely ignored by the media and which suddenly became newsworthy through a tragedy. We need, and I hope that Scotland can have a media where stories that have complex issues like housing and inequality, class and race, covered in its mainstream media. And the media reaction to Grenfell was shocking because those that are often invisible, and in this case it was poor people and brown and black people living in one of the richest boroughs in London, they were made visible through a tragedy, and that's only when a media platform was provided and offered to them to talk. Mainstream press was sympathetic for a time, as is to be expected, but that quickly subsided when angry people, people who had questions, stormed local council offices, and blame quickly looked past governments and issues around regulations and looked past all the warnings. And it was quickly shifted and put onto one person whose home that the fire had started. And he was depicted as a reckless human being and became the scapegoat. Another example here is deaths in custody. And since 1990, there have been 1,061 deaths in custody. And a disproportionate amount of these deaths are of black people and people of colour in restraint-related deaths. But these stories still don't make the papers. Scotland's current narrative insists upon its exceptionalism, and that's gently guided by an emphasis on citizenship and not ethnicity. But by recognising the attitudes which exist in our society, which allowed the death of Sheku Bayo in police custody, and the death of an unnamed detainee at our own detention centre in Dungavel, that these mirror those attitudes of the British government, and that's where Scotland could be exceptional by speaking out about these. Sheku was killed in police custody in 2015, for those of you that don't know, in Scotland. In Scotland, with its comparatively smaller population of black people, in a town with a population of just under 50,000 people. The media here represented and replicated the exact same methods and techniques that media in England does when it's referring to issues around black deaths in custody. At first, he was depicted as wielding a machete. Next, it was a knife, then a blade. A policewoman had been stabbed. Next, she'd not been, but had been hospitalised nonetheless. Over the weeks, different accounts emerged. After being beaten with batons and sprayed with CS spray and pepper spray, he was taken to hospital still in handcuffs, where he died. And pathologists were told that the use of sprays, known to have caused death in a number of other cases, known to cause death in a number of other cases, and a post-mortem report failed to mention that these had been used at all. So the stories and experiences of issues that we live with, and and there's quite a convenient break, a bit of light-hearted interjection. But speaking about race and speaking about blackness and speaking about whiteness is uncomfortable. I don't proclaim to be the person who speaks for every single black person in Scotland. I never expected to be the person fighting for race equality and doing a lot of anti-racism work and equality work. But a better Scotland needs to provide an accurate representation of the lives of people who live them. Why don't we challenge those stories? Why don't we feel that we deserve a better media? Why don't we feel that we deserve to know what lies behind harmful decision making? Don't we deserve a media which has no agenda except providing like non-biased information in the public interest? Don't we feel that we deserve to create a Scotland that does recognise all these issues, all these secrets and difficult things that we don't want to speak about, and have these conversations that it doesn't become an awkward brown person sitting at the end of a table having to speak about these issues? BBC got in contact with me yesterday, I think it was, asking if I could provide a comment around Sir Alan Sugar's racist tweet, and I couldn't, I was busy. And I listened to a bit of it, and they had a black woman and a white man saying this is racist and this isn't racist. And similarly, when they've asked me to help them like with research, they've asked if I can find them women who are singing in a choir, which is a stereotype in case you don't know, and have black women, and a gospel choir, and young black people playing sports. And I've been having like very long conversations, very hard conversations with them. But a lot of this comes from us as well. If we see things like in the press, when we see that people are being treated unfairly, there's been, you know, a huge, huge backlash against sexual assault through the Me Too campaign, which was, you know, started by a black woman in America, which not a lot of people know. But we should be doing the same thing, like with our media, in our day-to-day. Language is important, as we've heard. Language helps us feel as if we're part of a community. Language gives us the tools to explain to other people how we feel about things. But at the same time, just because language changes, it doesn't necessarily change the deep-rooted structures of inequality and oppression and discrimination that all of us, most of us, some of us, will know of or experience at some point in our lives. And I think I'm going to stop there because I think I've gone way over 20 minutes.
Thank you very much, Roxanne. That was excellent. I wonder just before Tasmina does her roundup, I think it might be quite important to reflect on some of the things that everyone was saying. As a woman and mother in Argyll and Bute, Scotland, I am inspired, I think, by the people around this table. I think it's really important to be able to take those opportunities to reflect where we are as a society and where do young people feel we need to be, and that we're actually listening to young people as part of the solution rather than the young people who just do as they're told, is that? And I'm delighted that that's not the case. I think when we're speaking about being able to accept criticism, I think that's really crucial in going forward. How can Scotland be exceptional? You know, what could we be? And yeah, as I say, I'm very honoured, I think, to be sitting amongst everyone this evening. So, Tasmina?
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. It's actually really difficult. That was fantastic, all of you. Absolutely amazing. Really difficult to follow what we've just heard. And I think the best thing is just to give a roundup and how I think you've come up with three different streams about how we can make Scotland a better country, or what type of place that we can build for ourselves to live in. I mean, I personally get so much of what you've said. Leila, Roxanne, because I'm of mixed race too. I was my father was born in India, moved to Pakistan, and you know, when I was in school in the sort of late 70s, 80s, I was the first mixed race kid in my primary school. I used to get beaten up, kicked, and all the rest of it, but I didn't tell my dad, didn't tell my parents, because I didn't want them to know, I didn't want them to feel, because of them I was suffering. And I make the point because I feel, and you've mentioned it too, Noel, about this sort of use of language and step back in time sometimes, that I ask my kids, I've got four children, and my youngest is just in primary five, but she gets abuse now for being a Muslim. So it's just really interesting how it can be about colour, it can be about ethnicity, it can be about background, it can be about religion, but clearly there's a lot of work to do. And that brings me full circle. Your remarks I'd like to take on board. And first of all, Noel, because you talked about compassion and being able to encourage people to be compassionate people, understand about the different people that make up our society with tolerance and love and understanding, and take that into their households. Because where are these attitudes coming from, particularly in young children? Obviously it's a lot to do with what they see on the internet, but also a lot in terms of what they hear at home. So compassion is really important. It's what makes us all good people. And I mean, I come from a community that had really a lot of difficulty with equal marriage, the idea of equal marriage. I think the Muslim community at the start find a lot of difficulties with it. Again, but we've come an awful long way now. I'm really proud and pleased to say. And what I would say to them is every single strand of equality, whether it's in relation to disabled rights or LGBTI rights or rights in terms of your colour,
you know, if you believe in human rights, there's no one right that's more virtuous, more worthy than any other. So you either believe in them all or don't ask us to support any of them. And that's the way it has to be. And I'm really pleased to see so many communities have come a long way. But the idea about compassion and the bravery it takes, this is your first big speech, I know that. I don't know if everybody here knows that. It's the first time you spoke in depth and in honesty, with honesty. And as we, because this is of course leads on to politics and the type of Scotland we can build and the opportunity we can have to build that, there is absolutely no doubt that people will trust in any election, in any choice that faces them in the future, genuine individuals, people who have an interesting life, who face lots of challenges, but people who they can trust. And I think that's people like you. And thank you very much for everything you said, which is moving and you held it together. So all power to your elbow. That's not an easy thing to do. And of course, you've been supported by Eulene. Congratulations in your role. I hope you enjoy. Hope you enjoyed. You've got another year.
Yeah.
I was only in for two. I mean, it's not. It's a tough old world as politics. But you're already doing really well. And as Nuala talked about compassion, you brought it on to practicalities. What we could do in the country, we could build from a very practical perspective. And obviously, around you, you see the issue of homelessness, housing, the importance of education, and real practical steps that we can take to make that better for everyone. Period. Poverty. Absolutely, it's horrific. There are stories of all around the world. In fact, yesterday I was just watching a programme. There was an Indian film made not that long ago, which is really taboo about the idea of periods and women not having sanitary products available to them. Even in Ramadan, and I'm a Muslim, so I fasted in the last month. There was conversations on the internet about Muslims. So if you're a woman and you have a period, then you're not supposed to fast because you're not well and it's difficult. It's too challenging anyway. So it's not necessary. You're not required to fast on those days. But women in Muslim households are being shamed, you know, by being told you mustn't eat in front of anyone because they all know you've got your period, etc. So, you know, again, we're able to discuss these things now. We're moving on. But period poverty is a scourge in our society. The idea that there are young girls and women who don't have access to products. It's really horrific, and that is all changing. And we'll all have seen in places we visit now where they're in the toilets, and quite rightly so. And then coming on to Leila or Roxanne, you said so many things that chime with so much that I believe in. Your point about feminism, and I know you breathed over it in terms of it's how we deal with women of colour in feminism, is a really important one, and one I've heard from so many women of colour, that where do we fit into this idea of feminism, and is feminism as inclusive as it can be in terms of all of those who make it up? The idea of intersectionality, of course, exists. So I think the main point I would take from what Leila Roxanne said in terms of how we take a country forward and how we build a better country is the idea of inclusiveness, about taking absolutely everyone in that society along with them to help build it into a better place. So I hope that gives a roundup. It's really great to be on a panel of women. All of us will have been in experiences, some of us in shorter lives than the rest of us, where you're on panels with men and the audience is predominantly men, and it's a really difficult place to be. It's just something really nice about having an all-women panel. And one thing I'll say just before I sit down, as a political party, this is not a political event, but I think a lot of political parties have come a long way in terms of equality for women. But despite the fact we think we've come really far, I have spoken at events recently in my own party where men have asked why we don't have all men events, all men this and all men that. Well, good luck to you. If you want them, go and have them. The point is that we're just not prepared to hang around and wait for it to happen. So you need to suck it up, because that's just the way it is. But you're most welcome to do so. But I'm really proud, very proud Asian Scot. And in the referendum, there were various different censuses about how communities voted. So I'll leave you with this point about my community, is that when the Asian community were asked how they identified themselves, the majority said, as Scottish Asians. Isn't that a nice thought? Well, I said, thank you.
Thank you, Tasmina, and I think I probably, as the shortest person in the panel, should probably stand up. I should have done that earlier on. Now is an opportunity for people in the audience to ask any questions you have of the panel. I know we had put post-it notes out. Then I'm happy to sort of read out the questions. Or if you're happy to actually just ask the question, then we're absolutely fine with that. So I think this mic will need to go to whoever's asking the question. I don't know if we have someone that can, or do you want me to go ahead? Graham, excellent. So does anyone have any questions for the panel?
I have a question generally to anybody who cares to answer it. It's probably not a controversial statement to make, but many of the problems in Scotland and in Britain as a whole, for example Brexit, are down to a completely unrepresentative media, where concentrations of power and, I mean, they regulate themselves, for God's sake. You know. So, how do we change that, both as individuals and politically? What do we do to make sure that this anti-democratic scourge in our society does not survive in an independent Scotland? So that's open to anybody who would like to answer.
Okay, could is there any panel members who would like to jump in first?
Why did the media one have to be first? I've just finished talking. What individuals can do, and it's what I say quite a lot whenever anybody asks me like what to do about media, is you choose your media. You choose what you want to read. You choose what you want to consume. Most of us are on Twitter now. Most of us are on Facebook. A lot of things are online. We know that the majority of media are owned by powerful elites. It's like five main, it's concentrated in five like main house, organisations. But there are alternatives, like the FERA. We're a bit longer in the tooth because we do investigative journalism, which means that we don't get stories out as quickly as people need them to get out. There's other media like Common Space, but there are other media, and then when you don't see like media that you agree with, when you think that something is undemocratic, that something is racist, that something is transphobic, that something is homophobic, it's, you know, against like working class, like, you know, report it. There are press regulators. We are the press is regulated. You can report what you don't like. The thing is, most people just don't know how to, or just don't have the energy to, or think that they don't feel that it make any difference. People become complacent. But in the same way that you could argue that mainstream media doesn't serve as crucial a role like in society anymore, that yes, people get their news from Twitter, from Facebook, from sources that aren't necessarily part of the big evils, but at the same time there's people like saying things that replicate those exact, it replicates that language, reinforces like those same stereotypes. So report these people to Twitter, report the bot accounts, report things that you don't see. It takes time out of your day, but there's a whole different world and ideology that is being created like online, and what you see, and you know, there's conversations I know that take place within Scottish media and a few of the big players within Scottish media landscape, journalists. And I have a perfectly curated Twitter feed that I don't really pay attention to that. And somebody says to me, did you see this spat that happened? I'm like, no. And, you know, it turns out that this has been like a big, you know, personality clash. Somebody said something they don't like. But that doesn't translate to most of us, you know, because most of us aren't paying attention. If you want your mainstream media to change, report things you see, hold power accountable. And feel empowered to do so. There are guidelines, for example, the NUJ, National Union Journalists, provides guidelines that journalists should be reporting around mental health, around suicide, around housing, around race, around Islamophobia, which have all been created by, and we've worked with people from each of those groups. So there are guidelines. If journalists choose not to follow them, they're not going to follow them, but you can put them out of a job, you can make their life a little bit more difficult, but that sense of empowerment falls on you as well. And collectively, again, it's always about collective action. The more of us that do it, the more that you can change the narrative. And write yourself. If you have something to say, write. There's so many places that accept pitches now. Create a counter narrative instead of, I don't know, you know, just keeping it within like a wee room. Go out and make change. Make the change you want to be.
The media question is always the one that comes up. And a couple of things I'd say about it. The broadcasters, of course, are regulated by Ofcom. Newspapers are self-regulating. Of course, you'll be aware of the vote in Parliament in relation to Leveson 2 not that long ago, when the press thought it was a dreadful thing for them to be regulated independently when it was all right for everybody else to be so. But that's me just, that's my view on that. I think there should be independent press regulation. The point, and I think that there's some great journalism that goes on. We really have got some great journalists. Where there are issues is where some journalists have blurred the lines between reporting fact and giving opinion. And that's where a loss of faith in journalism, unfortunately, has occurred. To take the question a bit broader as to how we fix it, I think we need to encourage more people into journalism. But the same challenges are there that exist in politics. A lot of women don't want to go into journalism because, you know, even if you're in the lobby at Westminster, it's not a great place to be for women. They'll tell you that themselves. And the idea of it being very much sort of a man's world certainly exists. So I think the challenges that face people in politics also straddle journalism as well. But in saying that, we have opportunities to put out some really good positive stories. And it seems unfortunate that most of the stuff that we're reading, and I know Brexit is an absolute despair, but we mustn't lose the good stories that do happen and the good news that exists, because as a country we've got a lot to feel and be proud of. But I often feel that the good stuff, the achievements, don't make the headlines, and they should, because part of encouraging a nation to be the best she can possibly be is letting that nation know what she's achieving along the way, rather than telling her all of the things that she can't do. We managed to cast that aside when we changed in the referendum campaign, the idea of what we should, could and can do. And we need to make sure that we keep pushing for that. And if alternative media is a platform for doing that, then alternative media is what we must use to make the point.
So I don't actually buy any sort of form of media anymore. Like I don't buy newspapers and stuff. I get everything online, which may be even worse nowadays. But I want to give another sort of alternative spin on it. I'm going to echo a lot of what you said. Like, don't buy into it if you don't like the narratives they're portraying. So I would never entertain a media outlet that poses a really sort of discriminatory narrative of the LGBT community. I'd never ever go near it. But I think personally, what you said about encouraging more people into journalism, I think that can be done from a really local, regional level through a really simple thing like a youth arts strategy. So I used to be involved in Argyle Youth Arts, and that was really good, and it trained young people with media. So I was actually what was called a channel manager for Argyle. So I would create short films about voluntary organisations and sort of stories around the area, and people that would want to see them would see them. But I think stuff like that needs to make a comeback, because it's a really positive thing for young people, and a lot of people that came out of those youth art strategies and hubs are not existing anymore, unfortunately. But a lot of them have gone on to careers in media. So I think if you're starting them from the outset in a really positive, voluntary, local network, they can't really go wrong with that. They're not going to have a a weird agenda from there, do you know what I mean? So yeah, that's just sort of a different spin I wanted to take.
Sorry, I was going to nip in with that then. and Hillsborough, Sun, Liverpool still has lots of stickers up saying don't buy the Sun. People have the power to bring down these giant mainstream media outlets. Other communities have been creating media for themselves, and there's so many alternatives, and there's so many other smaller organisations, media organisations like Independence Live. I know that they promote and record a lot of stuff that doesn't get covered, so there are like alternative channels. At the Ferret, we do provide training, fact-checking training, freedom of information training. Like what you're saying, we understand that we need to get people skilled up, essentially, to be able to create their own stories. But journalism and even language around journalism puts a lot of people off. And it's a hostile space. It's predominantly white, it's predominantly male. The stats have changed as well, that most people that are journalists now aren't the ones that are coming from working class backgrounds. Most of these people have university degrees, master's degrees, and have an incentive to promote a negative story. Because people, there's an assumption that people don't want to see happy stories. Happy stories might give us a sense of unity. Happy stories might help us come together and realise that we're not too dissimilar from each other. Whereas, yeah, the horrific stories. But it's true, like, there are ways and means to challenge things. We are regulated. We're regulated by Impress, press regulator. So anything that you see that we've written and you don't like, you can report us, and we'll deal with it. The NUJ offers training. If you become a temporary freelance member, you can get training towards any sort of media, like how to write for print, like broad, how to write for print press, how to write for news, or web. How to make videos. So there are like training opportunities available, but yeah, a lot of that needs to be done like on a local level, and a lot of that requires like people coming together and doing that themselves. But media is changing. It's changed a lot recently, and like a lot of these things, the kind of powerhouses are crumbling, and all it takes is like a little nudge, you know, to move them in the right direction. Like show people that this isn't what you want to read, and show them that this isn't what you want to see. That's my 2 pence worth.
Thanks, panel, and worth. Thank you for the question.
Any more questions?
I hope you understand this question. I think it was kind of alluded to earlier that at best we're complacent, and at worst we're deluded about how equal a society we are. And I kind of wanted to ask whether anybody wants an opinion about whether that makes it harder or easier to affect change and more equality, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Is it maybe helpful to sort of tease that out a wee bit more in terms of people's responses? So just where we are in society in terms of our whether we're being complacent or what was the other?
Deluded.
And basically where do we go from that position? I wonder if anyone's got any thoughts.
Okay, I'll start just for Dean. That's a really, really, really good question, because if you're going to try and make change, then you have to accept the problems that you have and not try and pretend that you don't have them. And we do have problems. And again, I think even just this evening, if any of you weren't aware that there are issues of race equality that exist, you will definitely know that now. And I hope that's something that comes out from today, because as I feel we have rightly made many and great and more to come strides in terms of LGBT equality, I do feel, and to a certain extent, but not nearly far enough, given that
one in 20 people in society have a disability or are disabled. There's a lot of work to be done in terms of race equality and recognising that it is an issue, and it is an issue. Because it manifests itself in a number of ways. There are people that are obviously look like they're a person of colour. There are people whose name looks different. And honestly, Lila Aksam, you mentioned the phrase, where do you really come from? I get that all of the time, you know, where are you from? From Glasgow. No, but where are you really from? Happens all of the time. And then you keep saying, I'm from Scotland. No, but where are you really from? And these questions exist. And sometimes it's because people are genuinely interested in what your background might be. And sometimes it's just that they're trying to be careful, particularly in relation to taxi drivers, that they don't say anything too offensive to you. So I would hope we're not complacent, because if we are complacent, then we are deluded in relation to the issues that face us. And there are many. However, I am firmly of the view that in the main, I would like to think at least, and that's probably me being delusional, that I'm part of a society that genuinely believes we want to do things differently. The idea of how we react to things as a country is very interesting. How we react as a country to the refugee crisis, how we took disproportionately more refugees in Scotland without question and said we'll have more, demonstrates our differing views. The idea in terms of immigration as a whole, that we say Scotland has lots and lots of space, that we'd like lots and lots of people to come in and fill up, I think demonstrates again our attitudes. I certainly don't think we're living in a hostile environment. And the whole Windrush generation disgrace, debacle, and the fact that the government again has got away with not giving the papers for everyone to see what's going on behind the scenes is quite absurd, and they have got away with it. The issue of Islamophobia absolutely exists. Again, I interviewed for our television programme Lord Sheikh, who is a Tory peer, who wrote to the party himself and said, we've got a problem with Islamophobia, it needs to be dealt with. To which Sajid Javid, the new Home Secretary, says, no, we've not, it's fine, and just pushed it to the side, is ridiculous. And that is a complacency. They think that because we have a minority ethnic Secretary of State, we've dealt with the issue of race equality in society. So we've got a long way to go. And my last point is, we still, after all of this time, and again, this is part of complacency, since 1999, having a Scottish Parliament, we are yet to have a woman of colour elected to that Scottish Parliament. And that absolutely must change, and change as soon as possible.
Thank you. Anybody else?
I think it's really important that we don't become complacent or delusional. I hear it a lot of the time is when you're standing up for something, someone will go, but you've already got that right, you've already got that, why are you still moaning? So I think those sort of attitudes are what we need to change, because that still exists. And for people not becoming complacent, that means we can have proper discussion and definitely move forward a bit more than we are at the moment.
Thank you. Can I ask anybody else if you have any more questions?
Thank you everybody who spoke, and I'm sure we're all absolutely certain now that one of the things that we want in a new Scotland going forward is equality for everybody and openness about everybody. What else do we want in a new Scotland? Nobody has mentioned anything non-human. Nobody has mentioned the environment, which is incredibly important, and particularly right here. Nobody has mentioned the rights that are being taken away from us by the Brexit bill. What are we going to do to get them back? And what other things do we want to have control over? Apart from everything, of course, which is a given. But how do you want to go forward in this new Scotland? I definitely think we should be non-nuclear. That's one thing. And I think the other thing is about the press. It's all very well seeking alternative forms of news, but that's just sticking in your own wee club and listening to the people you want to listen to. It's not telling all the people who buy the Sun, the Daily Mail, and everything else what they can do about it and why what they're reading is not right. How do we reach out to get this view? So first of all, what else do we want in a Scotland coming up in a wider sense? And secondly, how do we convince everybody else they want it too?
Thank you. Can I, a bit of a chair's privilege, but could I ask either Ailey or Nuala, actually, if they could maybe, Ailey, do you want to start? Just what else, and actually, what could we learn from young people around how we start talking to people and how we start actually getting conversations around about this?
So I'm out of my comfort zone now, because when I write stuff down, I can say it really well, but when I'm on a spot, I can't speak. In terms of what else I do want, obviously I want more done about climate change and how rapidly it's moving forward, quite scarily. I think educating young people from the earliest stage possible about sort of climate change, what you were saying about media regulation and stuff, from the earliest possible age, gets them in there, because once a child is past the age of primary school, then they're probably, they've got their opinions on them from, like, you're looking at me now. I'm sorry, like, as I said, I'm put on the spot, but
sorry,
I was trying to gather my thoughts.
Could I maybe elaborate a wee bit more on my reasoning for that? That I think young people really need to inform us about where we're going. So we all have opinions and we all think that it should happen. And actually young people are, this is their world that we're really creating for them. So they should be informed and they should be able to influence, I think, what we're trying to do. So I did put Ailey on the spot there, but I think it's actually really important that this audience begins to listen to young people, and actually that it's their world and we're facilitating and supporting them, but actually it's really about what they think. So if Ailey wants to carry on, that's great, or if anyone else wants to take, I just think it's important as an audience we really begin to think the future, how has this been influenced? So I'll just nab a wee question when we gather.
It's a continuation. I would like to ask these three young people who all come from Dunoon, and I'm not from Dunoon. I came here 15 years ago, and I was fairly shocked by the feudalism and the attitudes, and I would just like to ask, what advice would you give councillors of the Moon and Argyll about how to create a better Cabinet?
Neil, yeah, do you want to?
Yeah.
We'll work our way.
Well, I did that survey recently for young voters in Dunoon, and one that came up was like what issues matter to them, and green energy and climate change is right up there, and what they think needs to be changed and what needs to have more attention and time put into. So young people in Dunoon are very passionate about that, and they also put in that they want to be involved in the political discussion. They want to have speakers come over and speak to issues that are important to them, and not issues that they feel won't affect them, sort of like just a whole event for young people so they can get these opinions talked about, they can discuss things. And I think about improving Cowell as a whole. I've experienced quite a lot of awful things. I've been kicked out of a golf club for being a woman. I'm not allowed to win trophies at the golf club I play at because I'm a woman playing against men. So there's a whole lot of things, and I just think we need to make sure we stand up for young people, for women, and make sure that deep places that are not accepted are made accountable for what they're doing, and that they're showing up for what they're doing. So especially like what happened to me with that golf club. That golf club should be showing up and basically just have all the attention on them so they do change. So showing people up for who they actually are and forcing them to look at themselves and change for making everything better for everyone else.
I'm just going to. Can I just go through the rest of the panel and then we'll come up.
I'm in quite a privileged position that I'm sort of the middle person for young people getting to the messages to the council. But even then, recently I put in a freedom of information request to the council, and someone got back to me about the request I put in, and then said, "Oh yeah, we'll get another person to get back to you." Never heard anything else. So I think getting young people on board meetings of the council and different department meetings of the council is really important for young people to actually visibly see who's representing them at the most local level. But yeah, I think getting that stage in is really important. Thank you for the question as well.
Thank you. Gone if we're still on deluded or optimistic. Small changes, you have to really relish and welcome the small changes and facilitate spaces and places for small changes to happen. And sometimes that requires like taking a step massively back and having a longer lens on, which is hard. Like, I think it's like you become so involved in the now, you don't really see like change that's happening. But like, be thankful for the small changes that do exist and that do afford us an opportunity to sit here and have this conversation, and how this has been facilitated, and encourage more of that. That includes everybody. I've forgotten what the actual question was. I actually did, because there was two there. Can't remember.
That one is how to give a
Cowell focused.
Cowell focused.
Yeah. And how young people can really shape.
Learn from other communities. Learn from other small communities. Speak to other communities. Swap information. Swap resources. Understand that, you know, Rossi's doing something like really, really well. So how can we take that model and utilise it here? But that does mean having lots of different voices. People that aren't from here but feel that they want to contribute to what could be here, and it's just making sure that those spaces are welcoming for all, and yeah, having a much broader outlook and hope that people take the chance to like put their, you know, stick their heads up above the parapet and say, I want to get involved, I feel that we can maybe do this, I have a valuable experience to bring, but you know, that involves all of us being a lot kinder to each other. And I think that's what people find quite hard.
Thank you.
Would you want to add anything?
Just to, you just said what other things we'd like to see. And of course we want all of the powers, but one I think that would be really important to us is over foreign policy now more than ever, because the actions of the UK government are not reflective of how Scotland behaves or wants to be perceived around the world. Brand Scotland is a really strong brand and a really good brand. And I think, if nothing else, that the referendum on the EU has allowed the rest of the world to see that this is really a very divided United Kingdom with quite differing views on different things. So, and of course, with the Foreign Secretary that we have currently in Boris Johnson, I think he makes the case for us without us even having to say anything, because, you know, He does not represent. I'm sure he doesn't represent us, and I'm sure he doesn't represent people's views in this room on foreign policy. But I'll also say that although I'm pro-European, the European Commission and the European 28's response to the vote in Catalonia is despicable.
democracy or you don't. You don't believe in democracy for countries where it suits you and doesn't impinge on you and doesn't affect you, therefore let's stand up for those democratic rights that are being violated. If you believe in it like human rights, you stand up for them. And the treatment of people just wanting to exercise their right to vote, right up to the treatment of ministers in a position who were able to do what they did in terms of holding that referendum, has been quite simply shocking. And if we are to be an independent Scotland and a member of the European Union, I would want to ensure that our representatives at that top table made that position extremely clear to everybody else. Because if we want to be part of that club, then we have to lead to that club and not follow it. And that kind of carry on and lack of response is quite simply not on.
Just before we come to the lady at the back, Ailey just has another contribution.
Yeah, just to come back to your question. One of the things going forward as an independent country, or even if right now just getting control of this, is in terms of the funds going towards foreign aid. And I was lucky enough last year to be volunteering in India for 3 months with VSO in partnership with ICS, which was a government-funded programme. And while I was out there, it's an amazing programme. It really, really changes lives in the rural communities in foreign countries that it works with. But while I was out there, we were having resources stripped back to the point that we couldn't use one projector during one meeting with our local community because they said, we just don't have the funds for this anymore because our funding has been completely cut by the UK government department that's controlling our funds. So that's one of the things I'd really like to see changed if we became an independent Scotland, our control of that, and the having, coming back to the human aspect of it, having a compassionate look towards it and understanding we need to be giving foreign aid to these countries that, you know, we dealt in quite heavily. So thank you. That's my question.
Jim, it's the lady at the back, and then it's yourself.
All I wanted to say was it's already begun. Attend the march tomorrow. The more numbers that go there, the better. And our SNPs and MPs walking out of Westminster like that was absolutely marvellous. It cannot be ignored by the press or anybody. Let's show them, go to the march tomorrow and prove it.
And look at the motto for doing this forward, and when you look at the Borough Hall, and when you look at the Queen's Hall, and how beautiful Dunoon is becoming, and you hear people talking about how Dunoon is moving on, so there is a lot moving on for Dunoon, and people are talking about coming back to Dunoon, not just the bad things about Dunoon. So there is a lot going on for Dunoon as well. So I think we have to applaud that as well, and the marches, and moving forward to independence.
Thank you. Oh, okay.
This is not a question, it's just that I wanted to make a statement for myself. In 2005, I immigrated from South Africa and I came to Dunoon, and I found it to be a very harsh environment. I wasn't treated very nicely. So I lived in Dunoon for 18 months and made it a priority to move away. But then at the end of 2016, I moved back. And the change in attitude. I'm a health carer in the community, and I work with elderly people, and I love my people, and I love being part of this community, and to see the changes. And it's the younger people that have brought a lot of equality. Their attitudes are changing, and I just want to say thank you to a community that I can see the change, because I left because I found it was harsh here. And now I want to stay. stay because it's a beautiful place and beautiful people.
Question for Neil and Aileen, being young. You're saying that we need to communicate with young people. What's the best way of doing it? Because I want to communicate with young people, but I don't know how to go about it. Is it social media? You know, people of my age don't really, not really use social media and chit-chat and all these different things that you see.
From that survey I did as well, it's making sure that, well, social media is obviously a great platform to get in touch with young people, but to actually get them out into political meetings like this, like, I don't, there's a couple of young people in the audience, but there could be more. And it's just to make sure they wanted, in that survey, they said, make sure it's a relaxed and inviting environment, and it's a bit more informal. So, and they just want to make sure there's issues that they're going to relate to and that they can get involved in discussions with. So basically, opening up places for them, and probably social media as well, is the best way to get in touch with them.
On the same aspect, we have a lot to learn from our older community and our elders, and it can work both ways. It can be like a really engaging experience if younger people and middle-aged people and our elders all come together in like environments like this, you know, as an event to bring you together, but also engage with each other more meaningfully, and that spending time together that doesn't exist like just on social media. I'm involved in the trade union. I'm the youngest person by a long stretch, and I'm not young. I don't mind telling you that. But I've made some of the best friends that I've ever had who are in their 70s, and I make sure that I phone them, and we go out for drinks, we go out and get drunk. We go out for dinner, and we meet like outside of our trade union movement, and I learn so much from them and they learn from me. And yeah, with the events, like, make it engaging, get an engaging speaker that the young folk can relate to, and have somebody else, you know, somebody that's older, and make sure that we just have like a more inclusive and interesting and engaging space. Like, that's what's going to bring us all together. Social media isn't the be-all and end-all. It's a small fraction, it's a small tool that will help bring some of us together, but it goes beyond that.
First of all, I just want to say it works both ways, because I'm a young person and I find it really hard to get in touch with young people. Say you're putting out a survey or you're on Facebook or whatever, depending on what it is, the people that want to see it will go to it, and you've just got to pitch it right. Like, what I find really good is going into schools. I can hear myself. Going into schools, school assemblies, and then the young people that are really engaged and interested will come to you. And if you can't get all of them, then you can't get all of them. And that does happen. But yeah, go to the young people, school assembly, to really work out, especially for what I do anyway.
Okay, can I ask if anyone has any more questions?
What we've heard today, this is great, but there's been a lot of talking about young people and educating young people, but I think what's possibly missing here is young people educating the older generation. because the problem, a lot of the problems that we're talking about here lie within the older generation, and we're going to be in difficult ones to change. So again, you know, we've talked about Eddie there, but was trying to think about how do we get young people engaged and so on. We really need to see how we get young people engaged to with the older generation so that we can change ideas, because the change is really going to have to come from above if we're wanting it sooner rather than later. I feel we're going to have to wait for the younger generation to come up, but it's going to be years, whereas, you know, we really need to take that attitude change to the older generation.
I wonder, is that a happy? Are we
No, no, no.
Okay.
Okay.
I wonder, in terms of Fair to Point, Tasmina, I wonder if you can maybe give a sort of wider perspective around about that, about what plans are for.
As a sort of reaching a conclusion, I think it's a really interesting point, and you remember in the referendum in 2014, and I think to a certain extent in the EU referendum, young people were encouraged to speak to their grandparents about how they were going to, how the grandparents were going to vote. And perhaps you should consider when they're voting that it's really all about young people's future. And let's face it, given the length of time it does to effect meaningful change in relation to various issues which have decades, this very much is about our young people. So, you know, when you think about the referendum, and it's a question I actually asked Nuala here about her survey, I was keen to find out, just before we started this event, whether we still had the support of young people now that we enjoyed back in 2014. And I think it's fair to say that's the case, that there is a period of time you can take people along with you before they start to get disillusioned in terms of what you're delivering for them. So I don't have the immediate answer. I've got four kids who range from the age of 9 to 21, and they've got differing views. What is important is that they feel that they're able to express those views. I think it's manifestly unfair that different elections allow different electoral opportunities to young people. Absolutely. In every vote, in every election, across these islands, people should be able to vote from the age of 16. And it's an absolute joke that the Tory party in Westminster speak in debates now about force 16 when they denied young people that vote in the Brexit referendum. That's going to deny those young people the opportunities that we've been able to enjoy throughout our lifetimes. And I suppose that brings me full circle right now politically to where I think we currently stand, where the major challenges are for us. We are now finding ourselves in a position where we're having to stand up and defend devolution. Just think about that for a minute. Something that we thought was a given in 1999, a hard-fought battle, 20 years of which we celebrated just recently, that vote is now under threat. Powers that we were promised during that EU referendum campaign that will be repatriated to Scotland are now going to be held at Westminster for a period of 7 years. What does that mean for us in terms of any independence campaign? It is important for us to be able to make the economic case for Scotland. Just think about how difficult that is going to be if in between now and when that vote is going to take place, must take place, should take place, if between that period of time the UK government, and it has form, squanders away more assets that Scotland has, that we're going to lose control over. Oil was just one of them. We can see the price going up, but oil never was the base of the 2014 independence campaign. That was the extra, because we knew per head we contributed more into the coffers than we took back. But now we're talking about our agriculture, our fisheries, all of these things that we are going to lose for an interim period of time, as they will be traded away as they have been before. We should be really concerned. And I absolutely applaud the hands off our Parliament campaign. We must continue to make that case for devolution, which is absolutely under threat. And I would love, even if just for a day, to take away all of the things that devolution has given to the people of Scotland, just for a day, so people could feel what it would be like if Westminster was in charge again. We must never forget the change we've been able to effect by doing things differently in Scotland and remind people how much better it could be if we had it all. But Brexit is a massive threat. We have a government in power at Westminster that doesn't care what anyone thinks will wheel people in who are being sick or out of the hospital beds to come in to vote in Parliament to get their own way. It has become the raison d'etre delivering Brexit, despite the fact that they absolutely know it's going to have a terrible economic impact across the country and, of course, will have an effect on the rights that we have become to enjoy, which are now under threat. This is all about to be taken away from us. So we have a lot of work to do to protect devolution. And perhaps by virtue of doing that, by using that vehicle, by reminding people of what devolution has delivered, we can perhaps once again bring people along to understand how much better we can be with independence. Because I want that for my kids. I don't want my kids to be left to live in a country as it currently stands, because where we are is not getting better. Where we are is going backwards in time. Where we are is welcoming a president to our country who doesn't believe in the rights that we believe so strongly in, that sending out the wrong signal to Trump. And I'm not, unfortunately, not going to be in the country to welcome Trump when he arrives here. But Jenny Godley's got it sorted. She has in the oven. For the sake, and it's the young people that should close the event tonight. For the sake of the people sitting around this table more than anybody else in this room, we owe it to them to raise our voices high and strong and not let people get away with what they've been getting away with decades, which is lying to us. No more. It must come to an end. They've been found out. Let's make it a different this time round.
I think it would be helpful actually if we can hear from the rest of the panel on that and then we'll close the meeting.
Moving forward, definitely having young people and older people just communicating with each other, because that's how you do move forward, that's how new ideas get formed. Personally, for me, I'm never going to give up the fight for independence. That's a big goal for me. The night of the referendum results came in was like the worst night of my life, and I never want to experience that again. All the stuff I've been through within gender inequality and in who I am as like a gay woman, just all the inequality I've faced for that, I'm never going to give up any fights, and I'm going to continue to stand up for everybody else as well.
With the thing about how we get young people and older people connected, it's always going to be really tough because people get so comfortable in their own echo chambers that they don't bother to go to other people to go for a proper informed debate because they're too scared that the other person won't reciprocate it. And a lot of the time that does unfortunately happen. But we need to keep trying to have an informed debate about what we want in our country and what we want for the country's young people. And stuff like this is amazing because although a lot of us have been saying the same things like over the night, but it shows that all of us young people are informed. Older people want to hear about what we know. So it's really positive to hear. And we just need to remember that it can be like this with everyone if we just keep trying to debate it. So thank you everyone for coming out again tonight.
I believe, and as I believed at the Scottish independence referendum, that was the tipping point, that we had a right good chance to be different, to really make a go of things. I'm still of a belief that we can create a place that every single person here feels that they belong here and that we welcome people here. And in much the same way that you were saying about Dunoon, changes, attitudes change, places change. The more that people see that people are invested in something and believe in something, the way that Dunoon's High Street is changing, the more that people feel that they want to be part of something, the more that people feel that they belong. And we just need to replicate that in all our communities in Scotland,
let's not have the city and rural divide, let's learn from each other, let's really come together, and hopefully before this older man passes away. that was quite morbid. I can't go through any more heartbreak of my granddad, so I would really like to see an independent Scotland for him. And thank you everybody for turning out. And we're saying young people, but there's two young people in this audience today, and we really need to listen to them and find out how we can make that really exciting, make sitting listening to adults just going blah, 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 really, really exciting and engaging. But thank you everybody for coming, and thank you everybody for speaking, and a huge thank you to our chair.
Can I just thank the panel and thank everyone who attended, and also for the organisation by Dave, Graham, the shop as well. Just to conclude, I think for me as a member of this community, I think, what do we do now? And how are we inclusive, and how do we ensure that everyone's voice is heard around the political spectrum? And for me, I think it's really important that we find a vehicle where lots of different parties, lots of different perspectives can actually come together and actually move this forward. And I think it's really helpful to hear from a Scottish Government perspective, do you know, about how that connection can be made between local ambitions and actually what we're trying to do nationally as well. So thank you for coming along tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
This, I say, has been the best meeting I've been at in years. And it's very hard to follow in and said on here, but there's one I've always had the job to bring in sort of bad news at the end. First of all, the good news is a tea, coffee and biscuits around there. Nobody's getting out here, the biscuits are eaten right closing all the doors. The second point is the Forward Shop organised this meeting, and the Forward Shop has in fact taken a bit of a financial hit in so doing. So you see there's a lot of big buckets lying about. They don't have explosives or anything in them, but hopefully on the road out you'll maybe put a small donation in to help us cover the cost. So that's the only way we can run. Okay? You know, we'll be big fun. So, and anyway, as I said, I will repeat again, this is the best meeting I have been at in years. And I have to give special thanks to Zmina, who's come down here, for us tonight. Okay.